back. It is time. My favorite hour of the week. It's time for My Side of the Universe on KOAL 107.3 FM and 7:50 AM. I'm your host, Todd Wilcox. This show is brought to you by Tractor Supply. We have a wonderful guest this week. His name's Richard Casero, and I encourage you to check out his website, see the kind of work he's doing. You're really going to enjoy him today. And if you happen to be at a computer, if you're not driving, be sure to bring this up and just look at what he's doing. Done some really great work on Freemason work, on monolithic structures, symbolism, ancient cultures. That this guy is really going to be fun to talk to today. So be sure to check that out. Make sure you go to our sponsor, Tractor Supply, see the things they have to offer right now. This time of year is a great time to get clearance items. There is all kinds of cool stuff. There's jackets that are clearance. There's shirts that are clearance. There's pants that are clearance. All kinds of stuff you need that are clearance, getting ready for spring. So now's a great time to go to Tractor Supply, and always, always, always a great time to go in and get your 4health food. If you've got a dog, if you've got a cat, be sure to use the 4health brand. You're going to love it. It's great. It's great priced. You're going to have a very healthy dog or cat, and you're going to be really happy that you got it. So stop by Tractor Supply and try everything they have. Try it all. So we'll be back in just a minute with Richard Casero. If you get a chance while we're waiting, go to richardcasero.com, see what he's got going on. We're going to be talking about his book, The Missing Link. You're going to enjoy it. Hang on, we'll be right back on My Side of the Universe on KOAL 107.3 FM, 7:50 AM. I'm your host, Todd Wilcox, and the show is brought to you by Tractor Supply. See you in just a minute. Back to My Side of the Universe on KOAL 107.3 FM and 7:50 AM. I'm your host, Todd Wilcox, and today we get to talk to a gentleman named Richard Casero. He's written two books. The first one was in 2011, written in stone. The next one is written, he produced, published in 2016, The Missing Link. And that's mostly what we're going to talk about today is his later book, The Missing Link. Talking about the things around the world. You'll know where we're going here in just a second. We've been lucky enough to talk before, but Richard, welcome to the show. Welcome to My Side of the Universe.
Thanks so much, Todd. I really appreciate you inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
It's exciting. Now, the listeners may not know, but you're another one of our international guests. You're in Madrid, Spain right now. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I grew up in New York, and I moved to Madrid in 2015 with my wife and son.
Oh, and what took you to Madrid?
We had visited here a couple of times before, and we noticed that the economy was very different. There's not a lot of jobs here, and they had a crisis. They suffered a crisis about a year after we did in 2008, 2009, 2010. And as a result, property values just fell down to the basement. And so we saw an opportunity to sort of swoop in and get some good deals. And so, just as an example, paying a mortgage in or around New York, you're spending $2,500 a month. And here you're talking about, one-fifth of that. Wow. So that's kind of a game changer. Your big bill is where you live. So if you can get that down to $500 a month or under, I think that you can pretty much have some free time on your hands. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to study, travel, and pursue my interests.
Excellent. And I know this doesn't really focus on the topic that we're going to do today, but just out of my own curiosity, what is the best food you've discovered since you've moved to Madrid?
Tough call. My wife's a great cook, and so are her sisters. So I'm constantly, they say, let's go to a restaurant. I say, no, let's stay here. My wife's sister makes wonderful paella, and that's a killer. So we once every 10 days, we have to go over to her house to have some of that paella.
Oh, that's awesome. I will be making that next Sunday. I'm sure it will not compare. As you know, the seafood in Utah, while fabulous, is not quite as fresh as what you get in Madrid, Spain.
So, It's so true. I know it. Even compared to New York, the best restaurants in New York, I mean, even here, just a regular run-of-the-mill place is better, you know, in terms of the seafood, than some of the best places I've seen in New York. So I hear you.
Yeah, absolutely. So The Missing Link, how did this book come about, Richard? What started the whole search for you?
Okay, ever since I was a kid, I've been interested in ancient cultures and archaeology, and not just one civilization like the Egyptians, even though I've been fascinated by the Egyptians. It was really all the ancient cultures. I was fascinated by the Maya in Mexico. I was fascinated by the Egyptians, Chinese, Hindus. And from a very early age, and I'm talking about like the mid-80s, you know, before the internet, I had books in my home. My mom was interested in archaeology as well. She had a lot of interests, but I started to pick up her archaeology books, and I started to notice the pyramids all around the world, you know, mummification all around the world. The parallels among these ancient cultures are really interesting. And as I started to study more and more, I started to realize that, you know, shortly after the New World was discovered, supposedly by Columbus, you know, there's a lot there, but we won't go into that. But supposedly after the New World was discovered, a lot of the Old World scholars started to see these similarities, you know, the pyramids and everything. And they started to say, well, there's probably a connection between cultures in these hemispheres, in the Old World and in the New World. So they started to investigate the parallels. And little by little over time, they did find, you know, interesting parallels. But the problem is that little by little over time, especially in the last 50 to 75 years, scholars have kind of reversed that trend and said, even though there are quote unquote superficial parallels like the pyramids and mummification, there really aren't any substantial, you know, depth to these parallels. There's no depth to the similarities. They're just superficial. So that never really jived with me. I saw the parallels and I started studying them from a very early age, and I started to make my own discoveries, which were mostly based on symbolism. Symbolism is a language in and of itself. So I started to take symbolism and I started to pick all of the symbols that I found common to all the ancient cultures. And I started to realize many years ago that they had this one similarity. And I started to call it the God Self Icon. God Self Icon. And it's in every single civilization. It's one of the most popular symbols in the Andes in South America, and also in Egypt. And also throughout different cultures of Europe and the East. So I started to realize that this isn't just a similarity around the world. It's a major similarity. It's a major discovery. And what I believe is that it symbolizes a lost universal religion that was shared by these so-called pyramid cultures. And so the book is about going to every ancient civilization, or not every single one, but, you know, the big ones, showing the God Self Icon, how it manifested in their art and architecture, and then explaining how this one God Self Icon was tied by every civilization to the same Makhch, speaks to higher consciousness and spiritual attainment and things like that.
Okay, so the God Self Icon, you're finding it everywhere. And as I was looking at your website, you know, you have multiple examples of this, even current ones, such as Starbucks logo. It's everywhere. And so you find the symbols. How did you find how they related? I guess that's a big question. You know, you look at the different countries, different cultures, and then you would have to study what each one meant, I would assume. And then you found similarities in the description as well. Is that what happened?
Yeah, it was easy to find the parallel. Okay, the parallel is essentially this. It's an anthropomorphic figure. It's a human being, and he's standing usually face forward, and he's holding both arms, or she is holding both arms outwardly, symmetrically on each side. And inside both hands, they're usually holding a pair of animals like serpents or lions. I've seen dogs. There's usually gazelles. It's all kinds of different animals, but usually it's animals. The animals are usually the same animals, and the entire portrait is symmetrical, so that if you cut it down the middle and you just got rid of one side and you unfolded the other side, it would be the same exact portrait. Now, that's the first thing that I started to notice everywhere. And I said, okay, there has to be, this has to be some type of a message about the human being, about the body and the soul and that type of thing. It really took me 2 decades to unfold it completely. And I'm still unfolding it now. But the basic gist I have, and that is, every single ancient civilization talked about this. They said that the human body and all of creation, in fact, is made up of duality. The sun and the moon, the light and the dark, you know, polarity, that everything has these twin sides. Jung called it the shadow side. Essentially what it is the idea that the world is permeated by pairs of opposites. And these pairs of opposites are inherent in every single thing in creation, including our own bodies. So cultures all around the world said that the right half of our body, you know, we have if you take a human being and you cut him down the middle, he'll break in two sections that are symmetrical. So the right side is the solar side, the yang side and the yin yang symbol. It's the male, it's the solar, it's the yang. The left side is the lunar, the moon side, the woman side, the yin side. So knowing this, I went to every single ancient culture. The Egyptians believed in this doctrine of the polarity of the body, the Maya in the Yucatan, the Hindus, the Chinese. Every single ancient culture has this. So what I started to realize was when the human being puts his arms outward and is symmetrically holding twin animals, what they're really saying is that they have hold of both sides. They have plumbed the darkness of their own inner being. They've come out and recognized the mastery. They've become master of themselves. And in fact, the pose is known throughout the old world. Archaeologists, they call it the master of animals. So in essence, if you go to Google and you type in master of animals, or you ask an archaeologist, hey, what's the master of animals? They know that throughout old world cultures like the Phoenicians and the Etruscans and this icon, they call it the master of animals. The thing that they don't realize is that this so-called master of animals is not just confined to the old world. It's also in the new world among cultures like the in Peru and in Mexico. And in fact, in the New World, they have a name for it also. They call it the staff god. They call it the staff god. So what I'm really essentially doing is, all I'm saying is that figure that you guys call the master of animals in the old world is the same exact figure that scholars call the staff god in the new world. And I like that because it kind of does all my it does all my evidence for me. It proves all my case for me, because if they have already noticed the master of animals in the old world, then clearly there's some type of an icon that they have pointed to and that it truly exists. And by the same token, if they have talked about this staff god in the new world, then clearly there is something called a staff god in the new world. Now, the trick is to realize the staff god and the master of animals were the same exact icon, and I call that the god self icon. So I've had help along the way, but only because I've done a lot of digging.
Okay. and how does that – so you found that in everything, regardless whether it was Egypt, the Mayas, the – all over.
Every single ancient civilization has it.
Every single ancient. Okay, including...
Multiple times, yeah.
Okay, including even in the United States, the Indians, Eskimos. Are you finding it in those type of places as well?
I'll tell you the truth. I have found it there. Here's the thing. Finding it to convince me, to convince myself, is one thing. What I try to do is I try to find so much evidence. Before I present a case, I'm trying to find so much evidence that nobody could point to it and say, well, that doesn't really look so. I've found symbols in the United States, in the Adena peoples, the Hopewell, that are God self icons, but with a bit of a twist. And I don't like to present them. I'm not presenting them to anybody, because I'm waiting until I find a perfect one where nobody could say, well, his arm is a little down, or this isn't exactly symmetrical. So I've found what convinces me that the God self icon was indeed in the United States, in the ancient United States. But I haven't found enough evidence that I think would convince others. So that's why I don't present it. I don't present the evidence, because I'm presenting what I know will convince people, because that's what I want to do. I want to make a case to try to to try to change people's views and to say, hey, you know, we're finding some things here that are not jiving with what scholars are telling us. Scholars are great. They're wonderful. They do a great job. I don't want to seem like I know more than them or anything. I think they're approaching the whole paradigm wrong. I think they're looking at culture as though we have evolved from cavemen and now we're these wonderful, ingenious space travelers. And in fact, if you look at ancient civilizations, they all talk about the exact opposite. They say that we've fallen from a golden age and that we've been in decline from that golden age. The Hindus talk about the yuga cycles. They had the Satya Yuga, which is the golden age. And then the golden age fell into the silver, and the silver fell into the bronze. And now they say we're living in the iron age, the Kali Yuga, the dark age. And this isn't just the Hindus. The Greeks and Romans also talked about it, and the Maya culture and the Hopi. And this is not something that I've discovered, actually. This is something that I've been reading about by past scholars in the last 50 to 70 years. They've known about this. And so I think archaeologists make a mistake because they're approaching the subject with kind of a preconceived belief that we've evolved from barbarism into high culture. And I don't believe that. I believe it's the opposite. I follow the ancient teachings that explain that civilization is not rising. Civilization is, in fact, falling. And I think my own life, I see that. You know, in my own short 45 years, I've seen a decline. You know, I've seen that happen right before my eyes. When we look at history, we can see a decline. We can see a slow but steady decline, the dark ages of Europe. You know, when we look at these ancient cult, the pyramids of Egypt are just the most unbelievable monuments on the face of the earth. People think that they were built by aliens. Why? Because they're so advanced. But I don't think that they were aliens that built them. They were a higher form of man, men like us, you know, but had a higher sense of themselves and had a higher spirituality. I link this all to the Freemasons as well. The Freemasons are a building society. They inherited a lot of this wisdom. In fact, the God Self icon is a Masonic symbol, and I show that in the book as well. There's evidence in that because they have the icon, they have a human being. It's called the Rebus. If you Google that, you'll see it. The Rebus is standing forward, facing forward, with arms outstretched in the God Self icon pose, and in his right hand, he's holding a solar compass, a compass with a sun above it. And in his left hand, he's holding the lunar square, a moon, a square symbol with a moon. That's the compass and square is the Masonic, you know, symbol. And so to have the God Self icon like that with both arms outstretched to either side and him holding the compass and the square, that ties it to Freemasonry beautifully.
That is awesome. Richard, we're going to take just a quick break here. And when we come back, I'd love to talk more about the Golden Age and the decline. We'll be back in just a moment with more of Richard Cassero talking about his book, The Missing Link, on My Side of the Universe on KOAL 107.3 FM and 750 AM. The show is brought to you by Tractor Supply, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to My Side of the Universe. We have Richard Cassero with us today. And as always, when I'm involved, we've got a little bit of technical difficulties, but we seem to have that squared away. Richard, before we went to break the last time, we started talking about the ancient civilizations. And as a young man, I really, really fell into the whole ancient alien things growing up. And thought that made a lot of sense. It made things work for me. And then over the last 20 years or so, I've started to look more at ancient civilizations that maybe we were more advanced and for whatever reason lost that, whether it was global catastrophe that we caused, whether it was some kind of global catastrophe that was natural. Something happened that would send us back into a more primitive state, and maybe we've had multiple cycles. How does that fit in with what you're looking at?
Yeah, that is exactly what the ancient texts talk about. We've talked about so far how the world is in decline. In fact, the ancients talked about not just a decline, but a rise and a fall, a cycle of rising and falling. Civilization does not just fall, it rises and then it falls. It rises and then it falls. And according to esoteric teachings, the reason is because we go through a cycle. During one complete cycle, we're awake and then we're asleep, and awake and asleep, and awake and asleep. And so during the awake part of the cycle, we're more spiritual. This is what they say. The texts talk about us being awakened human beings, understanding our own spirituality, our own immortality, our own divinity. That's because we're awake. But then over thousands of years, we fall asleep and we forget who we are. We become a much more materialistic society, a much more egotistical society, a warring society, and where our baser instincts take control. And so that's what a lot of people say that we have now. The Hindus now say that we are in the Kali Yuga age and that our technology is masking the fact that we are in the dark age. And I think is an interesting point. Because, you know, on the one hand, people, oh, look at this technology. Isn't this wonderful? Isn't this great? I don't think so. I think it's the exact opposite. I think that we've fallen, and this technology is just hiding the fact that we've fallen. I think people aren't nearly as powerful as they used to be, as our ancient ancestors were. You see this in the symbolism of all the ancient cultures. So, you know, following this teaching, if you really understand what they're trying to say, they're basically trying to say that over the course of thousands and thousands of years, civilization rises and then civilization falls, and then it rises and then it falls, and it continues on this cycle. And if you look at the ancient monuments in our history, the monuments that they're pointing to that are 2000 BC, 3000 BC, you can see that they were built by an incredible people. The pyramids in Egypt, Stonehenge, the Segovia Aqueduct, Baalbek. In the New World, you have all the ruins in the Andes are incredible. Sacsayhuaman, this type of thing, and the Mayan ruins in Mexico. I mean, all over the world, you really have these ancient advanced ruins. Now, I know a lot of researchers these days are looking at that and saying, oh, this because the ancients had access to tools that we have today. I don't believe that at all. I think that's completely not paying attention to the esoteric teachings, because for centuries, authors like John Dee, Helena Blavatsky, Fulcanelli, Manly Hall, Gurdjieff, Alan Watts, Wilmshire, Hargrave Jennings, the list just goes on and on. They all talked about the same idea, which is this idea of the rising and falling of civilization and the accompanying higher spirituality and low materiality that accompanies it. So this new idea that, hey, the ancients had access to these technological machines and they built these monuments using machines, it just doesn't work at all. It doesn't link to these occult tradition by these esoteric authors. And it also doesn't take into consideration the fact that we've inherited this system of Freemasonry, which is building in stone, which is building using advanced symbolism in stone and building using advanced techniques in stone. I think Freemasonry links to these ancient cultures. A lot of the symbols inherited by the Freemasons can be traced back directly to Egypt and the Maya and the Chinese and other cultures. So I think that this concept of the rising and falling of civilizations has a lot to it, and that because it's ancient, it's worldwide teaching, we should pay more attention to it. And unfortunately, scholars just look at it like it's voodoo. It's just mumbo jumbo of the ancients. And I don't see that at all. I see it as being a remnant of a very deep truth.
I would agree with that. And I'm curious what you think as far as with these cycles, the rise and fall that we've had. Do you think that's just a natural part of our own, when I say our own, humans' development as we're growing to something else? Do you think that's a healthy part of it? Do you think it's or maybe it's just a natural way that we work things?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's natural. I think it's a part of whatever we're going through. I think the rising and the falling is in some way teaching us about our own inner nature And that's what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to teach us about our own inner nature. And a lot of people are, this is just too far out for them. And I could bring it home very quickly. And I could just say, look, all secret societies, they have this sun and the moon. Right? You have these two symbols, the sun, it stands for day, the moon, it stands for night. During the day, it's hot outside and it's light outside. During the night, it's dark outside and it's cold outside. So you have the sun and the moon, and they really reflect all the pairs of opposites, day and night, light and dark, male and female, hot and cold, good and evil, etc., etc. So sun and moon are the two most important symbols in the world. You can find them in all secret societies. You could find them in all ancient civilizations juxtaposed against each other. When they're juxtaposed like that, they stand for duality. Now, think about this. If you look at our world, the sun and the full moon are basically the same size in our sky. Now, that's impossible, okay? How could it possibly be that we have half of our day is light and the sun, and half of our existence is dark and the night? These are the pairs of opposites of all existence. To have the sun and the moon the same exact size in our sky, to me, it looks like it's unnatural. Somebody did that. Who did that? Could have been extraterrestrial? Possibly. Could it have been a golden age man on our own Earth thousands and millions of years ago? Possibly. But I hold up this concept of the sun and the moon. And if you really, really want to study something, study the sun and the moon and look at the impossible coincidences between them. And you'll see that there's something there. And I think that the answer to all this really, really lies with those two heavenly objects.
That is amazing, and I just recently in the last couple of years heard about the sun and the moon, at least from our perspective, being the same size, and how odd is it, and how probably unique is it that the moon can do a perfect solar eclipse as it comes between the two. So with, you know, and the moon's always something that's been a very high level of attraction to me. I think there's more going on there than we know or have been let know. But what do you see, Richard? What do you think is going on with the moon? Do you think it was planted there? Do you think it's that there's something operating there that's still in operation?
Yeah, I don't talk about this in my books, but if somebody asks me, what do I really think? Because I try to stick to the facts in my book. You know, I'm not a scholar, but I try to, if somebody's reading my book, I want them to believe that I did the research properly and that I'm following academic standards and procedures, and that's what I do. You know, the one thing that other authors do that turn me off is just make up a story, and then for the rest of the book, they base the rest of the book on that that false story. So all of my research is based on facts. Otherwise, I'm not interested. So me personally, if you ask me what I really believe, and I haven't talked about this in my books, I think it's impossible for the situation to be the way it is without the influence of some higher being, because it's impossible. If you just look at it and you understand the importance of the doctrine of duality to all ancient cultures, if you understand the importance of this concept, not just to the ancient cultures, but secret societies, you know, type in Masonic tracing board, and you'll see that the very foundation of symbolism of Freemasonry is this concept of the sun on one side and the moon on the other, that this duality combines to create a totality. And so they're twin sides of the same one coin. And, you know, the sun shines theoretically for half the day and the moon shines for half the day or the night. And, you know, there's just too many parallels there. So somebody, it seems to me, has been trying to teach us the doctrine of duality. Somebody, it seems to me, has done this to us. Could be us. Could have been us. Could have been us during a higher age that we did this. Or it could be an outside influence. But to anybody that really has done their homework and studied the secret societies and looked at the ancient cultures and studied up on the sun and the moon and then look at the natural way in which they appear in our sky, then you know right away that something is strange here. And not just strange, but something is somebody, it seems, is trying to use the sun and the moon to teach us very deep lessons. And that's, to me, there's no doubt about that. I'd stand by that until my dying day.
And I, as you're talking, I'm drawn to all the science fiction stories and movies and TV shows that have to do with either ourselves leaving our future selves a message, such as, you know, or a civilization leaving a future civilization a message, that you have to figure out the, not the riddle, but just figuring out what the message is. I can really see how the moon could tie in to those kind of messages and forced forced learning almost, you know, making something so attractive that you have to study it and work towards it to find those answers. So I can definitely see where the moon could tie in very strongly that way, and really enjoyed what you just said. Richard, we do need to break away for just a minute for a commercial break, but we will be back with more of Richard Cassero talking about his book, The Missing Link. If you're home right now, not driving, check out richardcassero.com and see all the things that he has to offer. We'll be right back with more My Side of the Universe on KOAL 107.3 FM and 750 AM. Welcome back to My Side of the Universe. We are still with Richard Cassero talking about his book, The Missing Link. You can find the stuff he does at richardcassero.com, and I would encourage you to check it out. It's a very, very good website with lots of information. And while we were on the break, Richard and I were talking, and we're going to discuss the Freemason and how this all fits in. And I'm really excited to hear about this, the stonework, the Freemasonry, and just how they fit into this whole thing, Richard.
Yeah, a lot of people these days, and you mentioned the Freemasons, and they say, oh, the Illuminati, you know, those are the bad guys. They're taking over the world, you know. If I was going to take over the world, I don't think that I would create lodges and halls and be visible. You know, I would do it without telling anybody. You know, they're being used as a scapegoat, very clear to anybody who's got their eyes open. These Freemasons have been used as a scapegoat. Really what the organization is, it's very, very clear. Okay. The Freemasons that we've inherited today, the legacy of Freemasonry that we've inherited today, comes from the cathedral builders. And I showed this in Written in Stone. They built Europe's Gothic cathedrals, and they did a wonderful job. And these cathedrals are amazing. I don't know anybody that could stand in front of a cathedral and say that's a piece of crap. You know, these are some of the most important symbolic spiritual buildings on the face of the earth. They're magnificent. So the builders, you know, to me, when I see that, I feel like fuzzy inside, and I say, you know, these builders were good people. They were good men. They were caring. They were, you know, they were powerful. They were strong, and they left us good. And as a symbolist, I could tell you that the message in stone that they left us is one of teaching and one of caring. It's as if they were our forefathers, and they cared about their children, and they wanted us to learn what they knew. And so in my book, Written in Stone, I decode the cathedrals very clearly and I present overwhelming evidence that the Gothic cathedrals are essentially telling us what the ancient cultures were telling us in their monuments. And that is the idea of, you know, deep within us, we're immortal beings, we're eternal divine beings having a human experience, essentially. And I use what I call the triptych temple. It's a three-door entryway into temples. And you find this in cultures all over the world. The pyramid cultures especially, they built temples with three-door openings. I call it the triptych temple. And all the Gothic cathedrals have triptych entrances as well. So I found that a long time ago, and then I decoded the symbolism of the cathedrals to match the ancient architecture. But during this process, what I'd realized was the builders of the Gothic cathedrals, which I didn't even know at the time, many, many years ago, were the Freemasons. I learned that later. The builders of the Gothic cathedrals were leaving us a message. And so Freemasonry, this is when I started to understand that the Freemasons had built these Gothic cathedrals. I looked into the symbolism of the Freemasons, and it's all there. The ancient universal religion is there. The God Self icon is there. The triptych is there. Symbols from all ancient cultures, not just the Egyptians, but the Maya and the Chinese and Babylonians, Persians, etc., are there. And so what it very clearly looks like is that Freemasonry is a storehouse of an ancient teaching or an ancient spiritual religion that once existed and that was shared worldwide among all cultures, especially the pyramid cultures. And it really is very, very clear. Once you understand the symbolism, it's easy to go from an ancient civilization like Egypt to a Masonic lodge built in the last 100 years and match the symbols and say, hey, you know, I got it. I know what this means. This is a symbol of the soul, or this is a symbol of the body, or this is a symbol of duality, or the checkerboard square. I mean, you have black and white squares. It's the duality of the world. It's, you know, some is black, some is white. You're going to have good days, you're going to have bad days. There's good and evil in the world. And so there's good and evil inside of each of us and our bodies physically. So there's, you know, these teachings have been inherited by the Freemasons. And it's very sad that so many people just repeat what they hear without really doing their own research. Oh, I heard somebody say the Masons were bad, and that sounds good to me. I'll say the same thing. Do your homework, you know. Really do your homework and look at it and try to understand it in terms of history. You know, George Washington wasn't an evil guy, you know. Thomas Jefferson, they say he wasn't a Freemason, but he was completely familiar with the Masonic doctrine. All of them were. A lot of people say, oh, the founding fathers, only a few of them were Freemasons. They all knew the doctrine. It's very clear. It's not that hard to understand. So, you know, I don't think the founding fathers were evil. I don't think Freemasons, you know, this whole idea that they're the Illuminati, I think is garbage. And I feel very badly for people who spend their lives pursuing this stuff. When if you just read my book, read Written in Stone, and you'll really get an understanding of the way the Freemasons have inherited this ancient world tradition. And dutifully, in caring about us, they installed it in architecture. And all it is really teaching us that, you know, in a nutshell, we are spiritual beings having a material existence.
That is fantastic. Richard, one of the things that we talked about also during the break was the way that the stones were put in. And I know I'm making a gigantic jump from the Freemasonry talk we were just doing, but we were talking about the stones in Peru and how tightly they're fitted, and they'll be gigantic, you know, multiple ton rocks, and then a little tiny one put in just for fun. And many times when I'm looking at those walls, I get the feeling that almost the stones were pliable when they were put in, you know, put in place, not exactly like concrete, but in some kind of a fairly soft fashion, where they were able to settle into their neighbors, if that's a decent description, to where there was such a perfect tight fit. They were still their own rock, but they were perfectly fitted. How do you think that happened? Any idea of how, you know, any technology, any level of civilization was able to do something so perfectly tight as that?
I do. You know, I've been through Italy. I'd lived in Italy in the 90s. I've seen these works of art that are so amazing that you don't believe human beings could have done them. Da Vinci, you know, Raphael, right? Michelangelo. I mean, you look at this stuff, and I was a kid, you know, 22 years old, looking at this stuff, just blown away. And I wondered to myself, you know, it almost looked like they had superpowers. You know, some people are so good at what they do that they're so far in advance of anybody else that does that. We see that in sports. We see it in art. You know, we see it in all fields. And so to me, I think you're born with it, yes, but I think it also takes drive and passion and care. You know, so for me, I think people that wanted to become a seeker or an occultist or an alchemist or really wanted to plumb the depths of their inner self, okay, they had to join one of these organizations, one of these secret societies, one of these orders that taught them how to plumb the depths of their own being. And you don't plumb the depths really by just sitting home and reading. You got to do – you have to be in action. It has to be action-oriented in some way. The alchemists did it with – trying to find the philosopher's stone, trying to turn base metals into gold. But it was an action, you see. The Masons also did it, but with a different action. The action that they did it was cutting stone and building, metaphorically building a higher temple to the soul, but in reality they were building a material temple here on earth. So the idea of them chipping away the stone, they were doing the great work. They weren't just cutting stone, okay? They were and in masonry, you have this metaphor. As they're cutting this rough ashlar and making it into a smooth ashlar, what they're doing metaphorically is they're turning their own base metals into gold. They're taking the base stuff in them, the lusts and the appetites and the desires, and they're not pushing them away. They're sublimating them into their own being. They're controlling them. They're mastering them. And there is a connection in masonry and in ancient cultures between stone cutting and mastering one's physical self, going on that inner journey, finding that inner performing that inner alchemy. So for that reason, I see these ancient monuments that are so magnificent not being a technological achievement, but being an achievement that was done by men and probably women too, who were trying to do this physical thing in the outside world to match the thing that the great work that they were performing in the inner world. I hope that makes sense. I know I didn't explain that too well, but
no, I think you explained it beautifully. It's one of those bigger picture answers that you don't think of. I look at that stone wall and try to figure out the technology, the techniques, how it was done. Didn't cross my mind that whole thing could have been a labor of spiritual journey and personal journey. And you know, just like you talked about the athletes that are so far above everybody else, or the physicist, becoming one of those masons that is just so far above the normal thing. I look at it as a view of, you know, I grew up doing drywall construction, and if you're within a quarter of an inch when you put a piece of sheetrock up, you're golden because it's getting covered with tape. And to look at what they did with the rocks just seemed almost impossible to me. But looking at it spiritually, I can see in my own artwork when I'm working with different things how that could absolutely be something that took place, and just that evolution. So I think that's a very, very wonderful description. Thank you.
Great. Thanks.
So we've just got a couple minutes left, Richard. What else would you like to share with us before we go? You want to talk about your website or your books or anything that you're working on?
Yeah, I guess I was asked to speak at Contact in the Desert, which I think is going to be June 1st, 2nd, and 3rd in California. If anybody's interested, I think you could just go to Contact in the Desert 2018, go to Google and search that, and you'll find a page with all the speakers. It looks like it's going to be a fun event. There's lots and lots of speakers, talking about a lot of different, subjects. So that looks like it's going to be a lot of fun. I have a new book coming out probably in spring. I haven't gotten a title yet, and I'm trying to keep it on the lowdown, trying to keep it real quiet. I just want to make a big splash with it when I'm ready. It's a fascinating cover, and I think the cover is going to make waves because it's a little controversial. So I don't want to give away the title that I'm – the tentative title that I'm working on. But it's, if you go to richardcassaro.com by spring, it should be ready, and I'm excited for that. And I guess – you know, just richardcassaro.com is the website. And let's see, what else could I say, Todd? It was a real pleasure talking to you. We have a lot of parallel. Our journey seems very parallel. And so it seems like it was very easy to talk to you and very easy to convey my ideas.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Richard. It was a blast, and I really enjoyed it. And we'll be getting off here in a minute, but if you'll stay on, I want to ask you another thing, but one thing is, I would love to talk to you when that book comes out. So if you could shoot me an email or a text or shoot something on Skype, just let me know when it's close. We would love to have you on again.
And oh, that sounds great. That, yeah, definitely. I definitely will. I appreciate that.
Very good. So thank you, Richard. It for Richard this week on My Side of the Universe, but we will have him back when his next book comes out. I can't wait to see the cover. That'll be my springtime Christmas, the anticipation working up towards that. So thank you for joining us on My Side of the Universe on KOAL 107.3 FM and 750 AM. I can't believe it. The fastest hour of the week is already over again. My favorite hour of the week is already over again. Told you at the start you were going to enjoy Richard Casero. Did I let you down? He was pretty good, huh? I enjoyed that. It's amazing to me still that we can talk to somebody in another country and it sounds that clear. Absolutely crazy to me that we can talk to somebody across an ocean and it's that clear. Technology is awesome when I don't melt it down. I'm really good at melting down programs, shutting off computers, breaking telephones, so I'm glad it all worked today. For the most part, we had a little bit of trouble, but worked pretty good. So thank you for joining us. I had a blast. I'm sure you did too. Richard's a great guest, and I really look forward to talking to him some more, learning about his new book and the different things he's doing. If you get a chance, go to that contact in the desert he was talking about. That should be a lot of fun. I'm working on being there myself, so maybe you'll see me there. So thanks again for joining us each week. Thank you for supporting our sponsor, Tractor Supply. They make this possible, so go down there. And I just can't tell you enough how happy I am with the 4health brand. It's all I fed my dogs for the last 3 years, and it has worked so well. I don't buy treats anymore because they love the 4health. I just use that for the treats, and they're super healthy and strong. So check it out. You'll be glad you did. It's wonderful to pay that little amount of money to get something that good for your pet. So check it out. We've got lots of good guests lined up. It's going to be a fun year. This is going to be our best year ever. So thank you for joining us each week. I look forward to talking to you again next week. But until then, remember, you matter. Until you multiply yourself by the speed of light squared, then you energy. We'll see you next week on My Side of the Universe on KOAL 107.3 FM and 7:50 AM. I'm your host, Todd Wilcox, and we will see you next time.